Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to do another show. As a matter of fact, it's show number 29.
Well, we're really rolling along here.
We really are.
Yeah.
And Father just presented me with a wonderful gift. I got a chronology of all the events that have happened here and a list of saints from this area that we are discussing now.
Right.
Yeah. And I'd like to make that available to anyone who would like to make a copy. Just please call at the station and I will get that to you.
It's a double chronology, and the one pages is dealing with political events that happened basically between 1555, which is that watershed date, the Peace of Augsburg, and then runs all the way up to 1848, which is the great year of revolutions. And so we just have that whole period of political events, and then set side by side with those are events that take place in church history, so we can see the relationship between the two. So always good to have the program. You can't tell the players without the program.
Also, this list of we were just discussing this list of saints at this time period from the Reformation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'll be working up another list of saints in the era that we're talking about right now. I mean, once again, you've got some really incredible. In fact, we'll be talking about some of them today. Some new religious orders that are coming about. A new emphasis on education, which is what we'll be looking at in the next couple programs, and but the list that you have there reflects from the time of the Catholic Reformation on up, about a century or so, and they're just stellar characters.
Incredible. The names are incredible. Just to whet your appetite, there's Thomas More, John Fisher, Angela Merici, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Ignatius of Loyola, and I could go on and on with this list. Some very well-recognized names.
Yeah, I think that's... looking over that, I think I call that program a wave of
we
saints.
Did.
We
did. In fact, I think I titled it as that as well. As
yeah,
a wave.
It really is a wave, yeah. It's a tsunami. A sacred tsunami. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to sort of take off where we were the other day. We were talking a little bit about Catholic spirituality, especially in France, and how it kind of morphs a bit along. You have the Jansenist movement, which becomes heretical, or is heretical really from the beginning, and then you have Pietism and Quietism, and we were looking at that kind of rather strange sense that some of the French mystics had of abandoning yourself so much, even to abandoning your own wish for salvation, which seems to be really bending over backwards and falling on the ground.
Right.
You know. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to get our feet back on the ground and deal with some of the things that are going on in the 1600s in France. Later, I'm hoping to put together a program that would juxtapose two very important characters of this period, Louis XIV, the great king.
Right.
And the Sun King, as he likes to call himself, and then one of the most humble characters of all of history, Vincent de Paul.
Oh,
the two of them are contemporaries and very, very different kind of people. We'll hold that off for a little while. But this is an age of great growth in the church in the 1600s throughout Europe, but especially in France. Many, many great things happening. So I thought today we'd talk a little bit about some of these saints and then specifically look at the work of one very insightful French priest in establishing the premier seminary for the world. I mean, it was the way to do seminary, which is what was the mandate of the Council of Trent. And then with that, take a look at the daily life at Saint-Sulpice in Paris, and then start looking at education in general, what was happening, especially in primary education. It's very, very fascinating, wonderful innovations taking place in especially in France. And so that's what I'm shooting for today.
That sounds great.
Okay. Well, just a reminder of some of the new orders that are coming about. I'll just name off some orders and some dates.
Mm-hmm.
You have the founding of the Trappists in 1664. The Christian Brothers, the Brothers of the Christian Schools in 1680. The Passionists in 1725, and the Redemptorists in 1732. So there's a lot of development taking place. And we'd also mention that a lot of things happening among the secular clergy, doing basically bringing about the dream of the Council of Trent of having a presbyterate, a gathering of priests who are educated, formed, intellectual formation, human formation, spiritual formation, and so they are seeking holiness. This might seem kind of strange that these things were not necessarily goals of a priest prior to this period, prior to Trent, but then the way in which we went about doing formation for priests was quite different prior to Trent. After Trent, you really have now a real sense that the secular clergy, that the clergy that are diocesan priests, it's important for them also to be men of holiness and men of vision and intellect. And so we have, and to do that, we have the development of a very unique seminary system. Prior to that, basically priests were formed by their bishops and individual and mentors, other priests, and sent off to universities for their theology, or maybe not, you know. So it all depended. But here you have some real developments. And the man who is behind all of that is an Oratorian priest. His name is Jean-Jacques Ollier.
Okay.
And he lives between 1608 and 1657, so he's in the first half of the 17th century, and he is really the founder of Saint-Sulpice. And the idea behind this seminary was to train priests. And Ollier himself taught that the Holy Spirit comes to us, and if we're receptive to the Holy Spirit, that he slays us, he reduces us to nothing, nothingness. That's our religious experience. You can sort of see a little bit of the Fenelon ideas of, you know, once again this quietism,
right,
kind of idea. But it's at that point, once we, all of our pretenses are wiped away, we then cooperate with the grace of the Holy Spirit in then building ourselves back up again, recognizing the dignity of humanity through the incarnation. That's so important, that the humanity of Christ. And so in Saint-Sulpice, there is a devotion to the child Jesus, Eucharistic adoration, devotion to the Sacred Heart, the praying of the Rosary, with each of those mysteries, meditating upon the physical, historical events of Christ's life, death, and resurrection. And so this really helps then these young men who are coming to Saint-Sulpice to have a real strong sense of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just going to be producing some just outstanding priests and leaders for the church in the next generation. We'll mention a couple of them.
We're talking what years, Father?
Now, we're looking at the mid-1600s.
Mid-1600s.
Yeah.
So will we see any of the benefits of that here in America?
That's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because what we will, actually, not here in the United States. Of course, in 1600s, the U.S.
it's
didn't
still
exist.
Early, yeah.
Yeah. But in Canada,
okay.
Yeah, one of the bishops in of Quebec is going to establish a seminary in Montreal. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it, but he imports some Sulpician priests.
Okay.
This is an order of priests that,
okay,
that their apostolic work is to prepare young men for the priesthood, and he will really be the one who will begin building then a diocesan priesthood for the Western Hemisphere, for French-speaking, the Western Hemisphere, which is incredibly important because if you remember in 1773, the Jesuits are suppressed.
Right.
And so,
oh, that's right.
You know, and so it's very important that there's a strong diocesan priesthood. And that's really a development that continues on throughout American history. We see this time after time. Certainly here in St. Louis, we see this with Archbishop Kenrick. And now I'm jumping up into the mid-1800s now, but it was so important for him to have a seminary and not only to bring in wonderful religious orders, which he did with the Vincentians and the Jesuits, and there's so many others. He and then later Glennon invited so many religious orders, so many orders of sisters to make this, you know, I don't know if you remember, but when I was a teenager and even in my 20s and 30s, we used to talk about St. Louis as being the Rome of the West.
Oh, right. I've heard that term often.
Yeah, and I can remember as a scholastic taking courses down at St. Louis University. This is back in the early 70s, and it looked like Rome. I mean, there were so many religious habits walking around that you just go, wow, you know. But that didn't happen by accident. That happened through the vision of people like Glennon and then certainly Kenrick himself. And Kenrick was one who saw that it was so important for his diocese to have a very strong presbyterate, a very strong group of brother priests who would be cooperating with him directly as diocesan priests. So you can see that what happens in Saint-Sulpice in the 1600s is transported over here to America, and certainly in the 1800s, and even to today, you know, we understand the incredible importance. Well, I'm saying this as a seminary professor,
well,
but nonetheless,
no, I think so.
But
we all understand
the importance of a seminary for the preparation of priests. Archbishop Bergoglio always says that no priest, no Eucharist,
that's
no Eucharist,
exactly
no
right.
Church, and boy, that is that's so true. So
one other quick question:
yeah,
you said Saint-Sulpice. There's the Sulpicians, they call them,
right?
Not the same as the Salesians.
A different order.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So along with this, you have other contemporaries, like, for instance, St. John Eudes, born just a couple years before Olier. He lives from 1601 to 1680, a pretty long life for a man back then. And his whole approach was toward what was referred to as a religion of the heart, as opposed to the mind, and so a real sense of just spending time before an image of the Sacred Heart, and just communing with Christ through that, and it really parallels the German Protestant Pietism that's going on over there. It's a Catholic approach. He's very important in establishing preached missions, which of course is the great work. It's a small order, the Eudist Fathers, it's known as.
And, I hadn't heard of them.
Yeah, I don't even know how many there are around today.
But they are still, there are still some, maybe.
I think so.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. They also established an order of sisters, St. John Eudes. Establish an order of sisters to school girls.
Oh, okay.
And so we're going to see some early education stuff. We begin seeing in the mid-17th century, in the 1600s, a real sense of the importance, and this is certainly St. Vincent de Paul is going to have a tremendous influence on this, of the home mission. It's wonderful to go out to all corners of the earth and to convert people, but we have to convert ourselves, and one of the ways of doing that will be through education, and what develops in schools. You also have at this time, of course, Armand Jean de Rancey, who is abbot of La Trappe Cistercians, And remember, the Cistercian order itself is founded in the 11th century, 1098. So it's a very, very old order. But he reforms the rule, sets up a very strict observance of the rule. And so the monastery at La Trappe becomes really an exemplar for others, and others begin imitating that. Here you have, you know, the importance of silence, the importance of a vegetarian diet, of a very, very sparse dormitory living, you know.
And this was at the Saint-Sulpice?
No. This is going to be at La Trappe.
Oh, okay, La Trappe.
And of course,
okay.
Here you have then the development of the of the Trappists from that. St. Paul of the Cross is in Italy. He also is very important in this sense of the religion of the heart, a devotion to the sufferings and the crucifixion of Christ. And from that will come an order of priests, the Passionists. How important that is. And once again, the idea of parish missions, of going into a parish and preaching missions, retreats, things of that nature. So this is an approach for the laity as much as for religious and for priests. And just the tremendous power. We know that certainly during Lent and certainly Holy Week, just to take time and meditate on the physical sufferings of Christ causes us to just it moves our heart, and that's exactly what he's doing. Later on, there's an order of sisters added to the Passionists also.
Right.
And of course, you know, when you start talking about preached retreats, when you talk about missions, parish missions, you have to talk about the Redemptorists. they were.
I think that's how we know them, right?
Yes, that's for sure. You know, I just they're experts at it,
right?
And of course, their founder is also at the far end of this time. We're talking about Saint Alphonsus Liguori, and. That spiritual instruction, retreats, missions. He does all of this in southern Italy, of course, but the idea is
not in Liguori, Missouri.
that's true. That's right. Yeah. And that will continue on all throughout. We'll talk a little bit about him a little bit later on. He does not have an easy life. It isn't, you know, it's a hard life. But I think toward the end of his life, he wasn't really sure that what he had done was worthwhile. Because it was
easy to look back.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there was terrible dissension within the order itself. It almost split apart, and yet the wonderful work that the Redemptorists did and do had to continue on, and God found ways for them to do that. In Austria, you also have another saint. This is Saint Clement Hofbauer. And he attempts to move into Austria. Unfortunately, we're dealing with a rather obstructionist emperor at the time. And so he's not able to work there. Instead, he goes to Bavaria and has an incredible influence on the people of Bavaria.
Okay.
And, you know, you travel in secular Europe today, and it really is. I mean, you know, in so many places you've got these beautiful cathedrals and churches and nobody in them. But, boy, there are parts of Germany you can go, and you can see that the devotion is still very much alive. It's very much part and parcel of the air that you breathe. You know, in Bavaria, if you're out hiking and you come across somebody going the other direction, instead of saying Guten Morgen or something like that, you'd say Grüß Gott, God's greetings.
Oh, how wonderful.
You know, in fields all over the place, you'll find field crosses, Feldkreuzen, where farmers can stop for a little and say a little prayer. I've gone into grocery stores where there's a beautiful, I mean, we're talking beautiful carved statue of the Blessed Virgin. As you go into the store, you know that store is, when it was opened, it was blessed, and the people there are, you know, aware. Any restaurant in Bavaria, you'll never see a restaurant that you don't have a crucifix in the main dining hall.
Oh.
It's something else.
Take me over there. Yeah. Oh, I love it. Okay.
Yeah. It's at this time also, though, that there is a countervailing argument that goes on. And a little bit later on in the 19th century, there is a German philosopher by the name of Max Weber, who argues that, well, he's a political economist, and he writes a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And what he argues, he's a professor at the University of Berlin, is that that there are certain countries in Europe that have really taken off economically and have prospered, and other countries that have not. It's mm-hmm. known as the Protestant work ethic. You've probably heard the term before.
Mm-hmm.
And Max Weber is actually the man who popularizes it. And what he argues is that Great Britain, the Netherlands, Germany, and the United States are the leading countries as you go into the 20th century, and that nations like Italy and Spain and, to a lesser extent, France are nations that are falling behind. And his argument is that the reason for this is that those are Catholic countries and the prospering countries are Protestant countries. It is a gross simplification of what, in fact, is actually happening. But his argument really revolves around the idea that quietism, pietism, devotions that we've all been talking about are uneconomical
mm-hmm.
and therefore distract people away from
working
and prospering and making more money and things
mm-hmm.
of that nature. And also then along with that, education. Well, that's why I just bring him up, because I think it's good for us as we're about to look at the developments in Catholic education in the 1600s to see, in fact, the same church that gave Europe the university system is now about to create the universal educational system
mm-hmm.
for children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And but before we do that, I want to go ahead and take a little time and talk about Sancel Peace itself.
Oh, let's do.
A couple of years ago, some of the seminarians, I usually have, once a year, I have a seminar class, and it's an opportunity for them to do in-depth research on some little specific thing they might be interested in. And then before the semester starts, I usually try to ask them if there's something in that era that they would be interested in that might be hard for them to work. And so then I would spend some time over the summertime trying to come up with some of this. Well, one of the seminarians said to me, okay, we're going to be covering this era in the 1600s. Tell me what it was like to be in a seminary in the 1600s. Well, that's not easy, you know. And so I went and I got some books. I didn't find anything that actually addressed that issue, but I found books about priests who had attended the one seminary that stands out, Sancel
uh-huh.
Peace, and I put together this tiny little lecture on what it was like to be a seminarian in the 1600s.
Oh, that sounds good.
So let's go ahead.
But before we start,
yeah.
It's French, and I'm not having it had any French. Spell Sancel Peace
okay.
for me, because
well,
I know
Sam
I'm writing it wrong.
Saint.
Okay, got
and,
that.
And Sancel Peace is Sulpice.
Well, I could read my notes, but I wouldn't have gotten it there.
Okay. Yeah.
That's not too far from how it looks, though.
Which is surprising for French, isn't
that's
it?
That's what I mean. That's why I thought we should spell it, because it's French, and
yeah.
For me, they usually just drop off the rest of the end of the word. But
well, anyhow, as I said before, that this particular seminary was really set up in order to fulfill the mandate of the Council of Trent toward the education and formation for the seminarians. Now, it didn't happen automatically. In fact, you know, the people who are getting nervous about the Second Vatican Council not being implemented or being implemented too much, or we've gone through this experimentation stage and all this kind of stuff, and they're wringing their hands and all. Remember that the Council is not even 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a look at this. We're talking around, you know, 1650, Sancel Peace being set up,
okay.
And the Council of Trent was actually almost 100 years earlier.
Right.
You know, things in the Catholic Church, things don't necessarily happen very rapidly.
Good for us to keep our perspective.
Yeah, and something like this really does. Now, that's not to say that there weren't attempts and prototypes that had been set up shortly after Trent, and there were a number of them.
Okay.
One of the first was established in the city of Rheims in eastern France by the Cardinal of Lorraine. And so he responds very rapidly, just a couple years after the Council of Trent ends. He establishes this seminary and basically brings 20 young men together into this seminary that he had there. But the end result is that if you were to look at the what they did and what they studied, basically they were glorified altar boys.
Okay.
You know, all they did was just basically serve at the functions at the cathedral.
Okay.
And so there wasn't a lot of intellectual or human or even spiritual formation that was taking place at Rheims.
Okay.
Well, okay, there you have it, you know. And a number of others also did the same thing. They set themselves up and not terribly successful or don't particularly have, they're not outstanding in any particular way. There's one that is, and that is, as I mentioned before, a sense of peace, and it's Jacques Ollier who sets this up. He is a follower of what's known as the French School of Spirituality. And so he is influenced by people like St. Vincent de Paul.
Okay. You know.
And there are a couple others that are lesser known, but certainly St. Vincent de Paul is. I was able to find out something about some of the faculty members who taught there. Because really, it's, you know, the faculty is what makes and breaks a seminary. And some of them were just really incredible. There's a priest by the name of Father Tronsen, one of the earlier members of the Sulpicians. And those who remembered him, as I read through some of these memoirs and stuff, said that he was a great big fat guy, very jolly and very fatherly. And
okay.
So, you know, there you have that human formation,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Very humane. At the same time, very spiritual.
Oh, good.
And here's that sort of key at Saint-Sulpice is that he's very spiritual and yet engaged in the world.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know? And we'll see this time after time. Another priest, Jacques Baurin, is a convert from Calvinism.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, sort of a Scott Hahn kind of a story
really?
Here.
Yeah,
huh?
Right.
Yeah. And once again, he is remembered by his students as being a man of incredible personal holiness.
Okay.
Yeah. And then a number of others that are cited, but what impressed me was that much of the faculty at this seminary were actually living in and working in nearby parishes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they act as role models for these seminarians. We have to remember that many of the seminarians who come to Saint-Sulpice are very, very wealthy.
Okay.
These are well-heeled families.
Okay.
And so they're coming with an aristocratic sense of being excluded from the unwashed masses, you
mm-hmm,
know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming in contact with men that they have great respect for. Respect because they're very bright, and respect because they're holy. They're personally very holy men, very integrated men. And now they turn around, these young boys, and they see these men working with the poor,
right?
Working in the parishes, you know, doing all the stuff that normal diocesan priests do. And they begin to realize as a result of that the incredible dignity that God gives to a priest to be able to do what otherwise they thought would be lowly stuff.
Right.
You know, things like bringing the last rites to a dying parishioner, baptisms, preparing little children for First Communion, sitting in the confessional for hours on end. These were great dignified works. And these young men were being called to this. So it was just a great experience. Coming out of San Sulpice, let me just read off some of the alumni. Of this, okay. Graduating from San Sulpice, you have François Fénelon. Later on becomes the Archbishop of Cambrai. He is also one of the great spiritual leaders. He is one of those who leads people toward quietism.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You have Godet de Marais, the Bishop of Chartres. Jean-Claude Vertreau, the Bishop of Poitiers. A little bit later on, you have Louis de Montfort.
We know that name.
Around the same time that Louis de Montfort was there at Saint-Sulpice, there was also another young man by the name of Talleyrand.
Oh, okay.
He has an interesting life. We'll talk about him later on with the French Revolution and Napoleon. Also, another graduate that touches my heart is Jean-Baptiste de La Salle.
De La Salle, okay.
Founder of the Christian Brothers. He's a graduate also of Saint-Sulpice. And so we see that these are wealthy young men coming from well-heeled families, with the exception of Louis de Montfort. He was from a very poor family.
Oh, was he? I guess I didn't know that.
And so you have a real sense of the formation of these men developing habits of detachment, personal detachment, and personal holiness.
Okay, I have a question, Father. You said most of them are from wealthy families. And I know how the seminary system works a little bit today, but did these young men pay to go through the seminary? Or was it?
Yeah. There was a tuition that was charged.
There would have been.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so for someone like Saint Louis de Montfort, he would have been
probably
granted
had a sponsor.
Some kind of sponsorship or scholarship. Or,
yeah.
Okay.
And that was very typical.
So really, a lot of there's some similarities to today, right? Or no,
yeah, the difference today is that we have guaranteed student loans. That seminarians
right.
take out loans to finish off their education, and then after they're ordained, in some dioceses it's forgiven, and in other words, the diocese will pay that loan back, and other dioceses
they
spend years paying off their loan.
Okay.
I think that's one little secret that a lot of people don't know about their priests, especially the younger priests. Is that a lot of them come out of the seminary with a considerable debt and not a particularly high-paying
salary.
Yeah, and so it is something that, you know, you live with it. You know, it's not a big deal. It's what you do. You know,
but good to know. I think for people to be aware of that.
Yeah, I think so.
And how important it is to support our seminarians.
There you go. There's a plug there.
Lesson to be learned.
Along with the formation that was done, and by the way, some of the information that I got was from Ludwig Pasteur, von Pasteur's histories. One of his volumes, it was volume 17, had several pages specifically dealing with seminary life.
Okay.
And the particular passage that I borrowed a lot from is called L'Histoire du Séminaire Français, for the history of French seminaries, but somebody actually has done the research on this, and you just have to go find his books and do it. But anyway, I was very impressed with that. You know, there was a real strong sense of Saint-Sulpice as part of their formation that they would avoid worldly pleasures, which is of course something that. Being wealthy young men, they've probably had some experiences with. One fellow who we're going to talk about a little bit later on, whose name is de Berny, was kicked out of Saint-Sulpice because he was caught one night he had his covers over his bed. He made a little tent. And when the priest who was on duty that night came and found him hunched over in his bed with this little tent made from his covers. He pulled it back, and de Berny had a roasted chicken in there. So he was eating roast chicken in the bed, and he got kicked out of the seminary for it. He has a very interesting life, by the way. We'll talk about him a little later on. But there's a very strong sense of what up until not too many years ago, we referred to as the mortification of senses. And so this was very part and parcel of the formation and education of the seminarians at Saint-Sulpice. Archbishop Fenelon himself spoke of Saint-Sulpice, and here's a quote. He said this: "I often pray that the primitive spirit of simplicity and of distaste for the world may be preserved at Saint-Sulpice."
You know, nice.
We have this impression of bishops in the ancien regime, you know, the time of Louis XIV, as running around with you know, all kinds of luxuries and living in huge palaces and eating and drinking and going out and hunting and gaming and all this sort of stuff. That actually is about another generation later, and we'll talk about some of these worldly bishops who were certainly not living up to what they should be. But in the 1600s, you have a bunch of very holy bishops, and many of them, as I say, are graduates of Saint-Sulpice.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's a typical day for you.
Okay, great.
Center of the prayer. The center of your schedule is your prayer schedule, and the center of that is mental prayer.
Okay.
The day begins at 4:30 in the morning. There's a guy that walks down the corridor with a bell, ding 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 ding, and you arose. However, in the winter time, you're allowed to sleep in until 5. So then you went to chapel. That was the first thing you did. You went to chapel and you spent 1 hour in chapel using a method of mental prayer. And what we do is this. And this is passed on, by the way, by graduates of Saint-Sulpice. They take this on as lifelong, and it becomes a routine that's used by many, many religious orders for centuries since. And the first thing you did was you recollected yourself and remembered that you were in the holy presence of God. There was a French monk living about this time, a little bit earlier, called Brother Joseph. And he wrote a book, a little tract, called Living in the Presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And this spirituality had a tremendous influence on seminarians, priests, religious at the time. So it's a constant reminder, and certainly as you begin your mental prayer, it's a reminder that you are in the presence of God. You recognize that you don't put yourself in the presence of God. That's ridiculous. It would imply that you weren't at one time,
right.
You know. But instead, you recognize, you realize that you're in the presence of God. If you do that every day at 4:30 in the morning, between 4:30 and 5:30 in the morning, if you do that every day and then make that part of your spirituality throughout the day, before you come to realize it, you're going to be living consciously, always in the presence of God. When you walk into a room, when you begin talking to somebody, and that really is a behavior modifier, wouldn't it?
Sure, it would be.
Yeah. So that's what you did. And then you then reviewed over what would be a subject that you had prepared for the night before. It might be a reading that you had done. It might be a virtue. It might be a fault. It might be a relationship with someone else. And it's an opportunity for you in the presence of God to mull over that relationship and to see whether or not it's a holy relationship. And so then you held this subject in meditation. And you dealt with it, you played with it. And then finally, before the end of the hour, you seek some kind of practical application for the day.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
There's a wonderful little booklet out. I don't know if it's even available anymore by Brother Joseph Schmidt. He's a Christian brother, and it's called Praying Your Experiences. It's a 40- or 50-page book. It's about 20 years old, but it does such a wonderful job of basically presenting in a very contemporary way this same notion of mental prayer,
mm-hmm.
and praying your experiences. I remember as a young religious how difficult it was for me to put my mind on a topic and then hold it there. You know, that takes a lot of discipline, and I didn't have that as a young brother. But what happened was I got a hold of that book, and it really changed the way I prayed. And so, especially as a teacher, a high school teacher, you know, you'd be wanting to pray about the mystery of the Trinity, you know, and there you're sitting in chapel, and you keep on thinking about this kid that you're having problems with, you know, with discipline problems. And after reading that book and really absorbing it, I kind of changed the way I did my mental prayer. And so I would allow, in the presence of God, allow this kid to come into my mind. And as a result of that, really found myself praying over him.
Situation.
And it really revolutionized my way of teaching, for one thing, because I could see these kids from a whole different, wholly different point of view. And so this is what was done at Saint-Sulpice, and this is, you know, that mental prayer. I'd recommend it to anybody.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And tell me again, Father, the name of that book you were saying, Brother Joseph. It's another Brother Joseph.
This is Brother Joseph Schmidt.
Schmidt, okay.
And I'll bring that in. I've got that around someplace. It's called Praying Your Experiences.
Okay.
It would be available through St. Mary's Press in Winona, Minnesota.
Okay.
If it's still in print. I hope it is.
Okay.
Following after this hour of mental prayer, then there would be a Mass.
Okay.
And then following after that, classes would be taken. The young seminarians would leave the seminary, and they would go to the Sorbonne.
Oh,
University
okay.
of Paris,
okay.
where they actually took formal theology and philosophy classes. Ollier said the following. This is why intellectual formation is so important. He says this. He says, in the pulpit, the priest must speak for the learned as well as for the ignorant, and uphold the truths of the gospel, combat vice, resist the torrents of prevailing opinion, confound heresy, unmasking its subterfuges and falsity. Okay? See, a priest has to be a theologian also. He has to be able to be persuasive in first of all, knowing the truth and then persuading others to do that. You can't do that just
right.
on your own.
Right.
You've got to be schooled in this. So that's why intellectual formation for Saint-Sulpice was so important.
And who said that? Ollier?
This is Ollier.
Okay.
Yeah. And boy, you can see how important this is, because what's the, you know, he talks about the torrent of prevailing opinion.
Uh-huh.
What's the prevailing opinion in Paris at the time? Jansenism.
Right.
And Jansenism is wrong, but it looks so right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so these young men are going to be living in, you know, I mean, they're just down the street from Port Royal, and the, you know, their Angelique and all these other people are lights, but that they have to know that they're misleading lights,
right.
you know. And so that's where Ollier says it's, you know, it's so important. But at the same time, you have to understand that that they also knew how to have a good time at Saint-Sulpice.
Good.
Yeah. I came across this custom on the 28th of December. Now, remember, it's cold, right?
Okay.
That's when the new year began. The academic year began for seminarians
oh,
at
really?
Saint-Sulpice. They,
okay.
they started the year on September 28th.
Christmas. Okay.
And what happened was that the older seminarians would, there would be a big procession through the streets of Paris. And the older seminarians would be riding donkeys through the streets. And the first year men, in other words, the new recruits that are just coming in, would walk behind. And you can get the picture, you know, and there they are. So the final guys, right before their ordination, are riding on donkeys, followed by the first year men who are walking, and then all the rest of the seminary, faculty and students and everybody, all line the streets and cheer as this is going on. And then as they walk down, then everyone makes great bows and gestures to the first year men. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine even the professors making, you know, welcome and you know, and doing these curtsies and all this kind of stuff. And so they get down to the end of the procession, and right before they go into the seminary, someone is up above with great big pails of water, and they drench the first year men.
Oh, brr.
This is December 28th.
Yeah.
Whew. So they, you know, they have a little fun.
A little hazing.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that.
Oh, as long as it's done in fun, I think it's okay.
And nobody got hurt, you know.
Right. Yeah. A little water, walking behind a donkey, you know. Doubt anybody was going to get hurt too badly.
But the studies were serious. You studied at the Sorbonne. Typically, you studied for 5 years.
Okay.
Well. Which is not that strange. I mean, you know, our present theologate is 5 years long.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So you'd study for 5 years. At the end of that, you received then a baccalaureate.
Okay.
And then followed after that, most were invited then. If you look like a pretty good student, you were invited to stay 2 more years and to take your licentiate in some particular area. And then there were some who would then be invited to stay on even further and work on a doctorate in some field of theology. Well, classes went on until 11 o'clock in the morning. And then the seminarians left the Sorbonne, went back to Saint-Sulpice, and went into chapel for reading until noon. And they would be typically reading from the New Testament during this time.
Okay.
At noon, there would be lunch. There would be silence. You ate lunch in silence. However, Ollier was very, very concerned that there would be no food mortifications. He did not believe in fasts outside of the normal fasts of the church.
Okay.
He did have a rector at one time who was all enthralled with the idea of fasts. And when Ollier found out about this, he fired the rector.
Wow.
Yeah. After lunch, he had what was known as recreation of rule, where the seminarians were to take a walk.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they walked in small groups, and they would have conversation at that time. So that's when they would be allowed to talk. It's funny, I came across this little thing that poor Louis de Montfort, not only was he out of it because he wasn't from that class of people, but he was also painfully shy.
Oh, really?
And so the worst thing of his day, the worst part of his day was the recreation, was the walk. And I came across someone who had mentioned that he used to memorize jokes so that he would have something to say.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so after lunch and there's a little recreation of rule, there would be choir practice.
Okay.
Then they were free until 5 p.m.,
free to
study. And at 5 o'clock, then they would meet back together in chapel to say the rosary together.
Okay.
Ollier had a very strong devotion to the Blessed Virgin, and at one time Saint-Sulpice was visited by John Locke, the famous philosopher. Upon leaving, he wrote a letter to someone else and had mentioned that he had visited Saint-Sulpice and was overwhelmed with the statues and pictures of Mary all over the place. So this was certainly a Marian seminary. The one thing that really there's a lot that stands out in Saint-Sulpice, but the one thing that really stands out that struck me was the special service that the seminarians performed for the local parishes.
Okay.
And remember, these are guys who are coming from wealthy families, not involved with the common people. They're coming in contact with incredible professors who are in contact with common people,
mm-hmm.
and they learn how to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They are sent out to teach religion in local parish schools.
Okay.
And now we're beginning to see something about parish schools, which we'll have to talk about a little bit later on. But we're starting to see this contact. There were surrounding Saint-Sulpice some seven parishes that had established what was known as charity schools. And these schools would be, at least the religion on Sundays, would be taught by the seminarians. A great opportunity. It's a beautiful thing. What you have is these wealthy young boys coming in contact, for the most part, with lower middle class and poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, and this is so important, I think it's one of the reasons why seminaries even today encourage their seminarians to teach in PSR programs, because here you have an opportunity then to articulate the faith that you're studying in high theology,
yeah.
to articulate it to children,
right.
and you know, and to reduce it to its pure message. It's just a great opportunity for people to do that. While this is all going on, there is another priest in southern France, in Lyon.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Charles Damia. And he has been arguing for and writing in favor of systematic education.
Okay.
These charity schools are kind of hit and miss kind of things,
mm-hmm.
and he is one who is going to be arguing in this mid 17th century that you have to have an established school system that is going to take children from one point to another. You have to have a regular curriculum. You have to have good pedagogy, and all of these. And ultimately, the man who's going to put this together is going to be a graduate from Saint-Sulpice,
mm-hmm.
Jean-Baptiste de La Salle. He is a typical student there at Saint-Sulpice, comes from a wealthy family, the de La Salle family in Rheims. They're quite well-heeled. He's got a long pedigree. His ancestry can be traced all the way back to Charles Martel and the Battle of Tours.
Okay.
In fact, the coat of arms of the De La Salle family has three chevrons, which represent broken bones, because
oh,
his
okay.
ancestor had taken three wounds that broke three bones at the Battle of Tours.
Wow.
We're talking the 700s.
You know? Right.
And so that's an incredible pedigree. And here he has the experience at Saint-Sulpice, not just the intellectual experience, but also the experience of school,
mm-hmm.
working in schools. And then when he returns, after his ordination, returns back to Rheims, he settles in for a comfortable life as a canon at the cathedral, and everything's going to change. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But he is an incredible innovator, and the things that he does in education is going to set the pattern for modern education on the grade school level.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely heard of De La Salle in education. So.
Yeah. So I think next time when we get together, we'll start looking at what the chaos of education in the 1600s, which is sort of at least is an attempt at educating everybody, or at least making mm-hmm. education generally available. Before that, it was a rarefied thing for only certain groups of people, but. We'll take a look at how that develops. It is a chaotic, rumble tumble kind of a thing, but we'll see how De La Salle really farms this together and gives us some patterns and that are going to be with us right to today.
We know that in history and that education really didn't start until this time, but to me that is just hard to believe or understand that it really took that long.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
for the concept of education
but
in
it
a
was,
school system.
Well, that's right. But it was, interestingly enough, it was resisted. This whole movement was resisted by the people that you would have thought would have been most in favor of it. And I'm talking about the philosophers.
Remember
what Voltaire did when he went ahead and at his estate, he set up a chapel
for
those poor, stupid
peasants?
For those
peasants? People that were, should have been choked by.
Yeah, he set up a chapel for them. He didn't set up a school. And that's part of the arrogance of these enlightened
just
characters.
Just holding them down so that they would serve.
Sure. I'd have to look this up. I forget who it is offhand now, but another philosopher of the period, when he heard about what de La Salle was doing, said he was ruining everything.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, you might as well try to teach cows how to speak French.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it, just absolute lack of any kind of respect or sense of dignity for these people.
Right.
And this is, on the other hand, this is what is going on. Now, there is education prior to this, but it's done through tutors.
Yes.
You know, and that's how these philosophers learn.
They've been educated,
oh,
right.
Oh, sure,
right.
Yeah, they had private tutors, and they had
and there were
academies.
Universities
and then there were universities, right.
Wealthy.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you got to the university only through having been tutored.
Tutored, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now we have really the introduction of universal education, and it is basically being done by Catholic religious orders.
Right.
And then it'll be imitated by public schools, but it'll be 100 years before
mm-hmm.
the public systems. Or even introduced.
Well, right. I mean, we looked at, you know, we're talking 1600s, and if we think back to America, and we're thinking late 1700s, and still not schools here. So
right. It's actually in the 1900s here in the United States, in the mid 1900s, that you have a real public educational system. And even then, we weren't sure how we wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember we discussed all the struggles with
sure.
that in the beginning.
Yeah, does a Catholic school, is it an independent school, should it be part of the state system? That wasn't really decided up until really the early 20th century. And
right.
at one point out in Oregon, there was an argument by a group of Freemasons that the Catholic school should not be allowed at all.
Right.
They tried to close down the whole system.
That's right.
It's not until the 1950s that we come to the decision for sure that there will be no state aid for the Catholic system, no voucher, which of course is still 2003 is still in question, in play. Yeah. So anyway,
and hopefully in 20 years people look back and think, what took us so long?
Yeah, and never.
We're
good.
Thinking that now.
All right.
Well, shall we close today?
Let's
Father?
Do. Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Thank you.